This interview is taking place on Sunday the 13th of November 2005. The interviewer is Judith Gertsen from the University of Victoria, and the interviewee is Mr. Dietrich Poetter. Mr. Poetter, when were you born?
15th of April 1920.
And where was that?
In Bonn, Germany.
Germany. And did you grow up there as well?
I grew up partly there, partly in other cities. As it was at that time, in Europe, you move very often.
Yes, did you? Where did you attend school?
I started in Heidelberg, then in Bonn, then later on in one of the schools of Salem, and in Moers on the Lower Rhine level. And I finished with the, what we call in German, the Abitur, the graduation.
And how old were you when you graduated?
19.
And was that just prior to going into the forces?
That was in February 1939, and then I went into the labor service, as it was mandatory in Germany at that time. And I joined the Air Force in September 1939.
In Germany at that time, what was the political climate? What sort of political beliefs did you hold when you went into the Air Force?
I was a young man from an old Prussian family, and we believed in Germany. We believed that Germany, after the First World War, was treated unjustly in every respect by the Versailles Treaty. And we were enthusiastic as Hitler came and saved this decaying Germany where nobody had work, everything was falling apart. We had, I don't know how many millions unemployed. And a year after Hitler came to power, everyone had work, and it worked. And there was hope, there was looking forward. And of course, the last thing we wanted is a war. You couldn't use it. We had to make work, to make Germany working again. And it did. So we were proud. We made every effort to justify the confidence which was set into us. And I just, about that, you can call it today very nationalistic, but of course nation was, that was our nation. We were Germans and we wanted to see our nation free and strong.
So at the start of the war, who did you see as the enemy?
Unfortunately, England declared war on Germany, and it all shocked us. We were all very Anglophile. I explained before that I have even relatives in England. And Hitler was so Anglophile that he never believed the British would declare war on him. And I think it was the biggest tragedy of the 20th century, because that triggered World War II, in which 50 million people died, and asked today what for. And we couldn't use a win. Germany was so destroyed after World War I and so poor. We had to work to do something. We didn't want war. I heard the news as I was working on the West Wall of Germany. We tried to build up defense because we were very worried that the French and the English would attack us, which they tried. So we want to defend ourselves. But all what you hear in propaganda, even today, how the world was in danger because Hitler wanted to conquer the world, is absolutely rubbish and total nonsense. The last we wanted was that. And that is why Hitler offered England always make peace with us. We can't use war. Give me free hand in the east of Europe, where we wanted to conquer something. But because we needed more room, more space, more land, more growing population. But otherwise, no war.
Could you describe for me the events that led up to your capture, the mission you were on at the time, how you were actually captured?
It was in 1942. We had fought already for 11 months in Russia, which was a totally different war from everything we had seen before. And the Russians, during the first 2 years of the war, mainly didn't even make prisoners. So I was long distance reconnaissance, and that means you're flying alone far in the hinterland of the enemy. And I was shot down already two times before, and I was wounded and had what kind of experience. At this time I was again on the mission on the railway which led from Kharkov, Kursk, Tambov, Kherson to the Ural Mountains. And this was on that mission. A Russian fighter ran my aircraft, and that was the end of the story.
Were you wounded?
Yeah, very badly. Of course, the fracture here, no kind of other thing.
And tell me about the actual capture and where they took you.
I came down by parachute into a swamp. On the parachute I had been attacked by a Russian fighter 8 times. Obviously it was a young pilot who was not very good, because he aimed on the parachute mainly. Okay, I got a few shots myself too, but mainly the was faster and faster. And as I crashed down, finally, I crashed into a swamp, which saved my life. So I worked my way somewhere out of it. There was a meadow, and there's a sun wested there. I have to run west to get back, and run down. The single shots came by. I run into the wood, and suddenly I lost conscience. It was out. And as I came up again, I was lying under a tree in the wood, totally naked. Okay, then the ordeal started.
Tell me about the ordeal. Tell me about the ordeal.
There was a crowd of boys and girls, four teenagers, and obviously they were so influenced by the propaganda that they followed this propaganda of stealing from Stalin. Every German has to be killed. And that was the last I saw. Once a girl at first hit me very bad with her shoes. And then one boy came with a big stick and wanted to warm my back, and then I lost conscious. And as I came up again, that was many hours later, there were red soldiers there who saved me from these teenagers. Put me on a stretcher and carried me away, and then brought back my clothes. They brought it back. So that was how it started.
Where did they take you?
They took me in a little village which was close by. And there where I was there treated very nicely. I can't say anything else. There were three young girls with white coats, obviously nurses, and they were tried to, everywhere where I was wanted, they put something on, the green stuff, iodium or something like that, and then took bandages everywhere around. So they did the best they could. Meanwhile, the commissar always was on the phone, phoning. I was out, in and out of consciousness. Fractured my skull, and my nose was totally destroyed, and several shots. So, and I heard always the word Voronezh, Voronezh, so it was clear that he was phoning something. And after a while, a car came with three very well armed soldiers, an officer, and they put me in the back of that car and drove me for several hours. It took over the Russian streets, Russian roads, to Voronezh. And as we arrived in Voronezh, I saw this half-round building on the river, on the Dnieper River, which I knew was the jail, because I had photographed it many times from above. So I came to the jail.
What was that camp called? What was that camp called?
There was not a camp.
It was just a jail.
The jail of the city of Vancouver.
Right.
City of Now I lost my...
Warrenish?
Warrenish.
Warrenish, yeah.
And they kept me there, and there it happened that I came into the hand of a doctor who had been a student of my father, who saved my life.
So was the doctor a Russian that had studied
a
in
Russian.
Germany? Yes.
Yeah, Russian. Yeah. I guess he was a Tsaristic officer who somehow, after the war, had started medicine and saved his kid by becoming a communist. As it was in Russia. He was a fine man.
And he basically saved your life, didn't he?
He saved, absolutely saved my life.
Yeah.
So,
and where you were interrogated in that prison?
This doctor said after several days, one day, by night he came and brought me some food. He came every night looking after me. And after several days he said, now you understand that soon the interrogations will start. And one day as he left the cell, he said, when you are interrogated and you should collapse, then I will be called, not as a doctor to help you, but to find out whether your collapse is genuine or simulated. He went out through the door, turned around, said, I will confirm it for you each time. And he left, and there I was laying in this cell, and what has he said? What does he expect me to do? He wants to help me. And he expects me to behave the way a normal officer should behave. And if he expects that, it must be possible. So he saved not only my body, he saved my soul. Many prisoners who, under the shock of becoming the prisoner, were badly mistreated, gave in into the threat, you have to cooperate with us. But I had, through him, saved my soul, because then I could think about what I'm going to do. And I decided, no, treason is not the question. So rather I die, but that I don't. I would never be able to look into the eyes of my fiancé, who was waiting at home. We should marry that time. No. And my mother would not look at me anymore. No doubt. And this doctor helped me really good. This was about 14 days or 10 days. Then they transported me out, because on the west end of Voronezh the first German troops came in. So it was one of the last trains, I guess. They transported me off, one lieutenant and five men for me. And I was unable to walk, so I was paralyzed.
What happened next?
Moscow was a totally different world. This was the Lubyanka, as the Russians say, the worst jail in the world. Many come in alive and nobody comes out alive. This is a fair description of the Lubyanka, where every political prisoner up to the last Russian despot, they call it, were eliminated and so on. And they had an elaborate system how to torture prisoners, which was awful.
What kind of things did they do?
Mentally, at first, they try, of course, to destroy you. They say, you're an idiot, you're dumb, you're a liar. Because you're lying, you're an enemy of the people, and we have to eliminate you. We will kill you soon. And they have killed many. I was lucky that they didn't kill me. Once they shot just over my head in the wall. Then he looked at me, what the effect was. And I was sorry that he hadn't killed me. And he saw that somehow. And then the interrogation was over. That's the last one.
What did they want? What was the information they were looking for?
They wanted, at first, of course, I was looking, this is reconnaissance for the army group's house, it was military base. What are they planning and so on. but after a short while, of course, this is not so interesting anymore because the events have overtaken it. Then they wanted to know how, as an officer, you behave, how the rules, and they wanted to find out how probably, and that is exactly what they wanted, how can they train Russians to imitate a German officer and go behind the lines. That is what they later did. So, all these kind of things. Then I was asked, for example, one day, what the names of the officers of my squadron. I gave them wrong names, and it was to my detriment because it was around mid of July. They came and showed me a periodical from the Munich Illustrierte, which was published on the 1st of June 1942, where an article was in about the chief or COC of the Army Group South. There's my analysis. His long distance reconnaissance came back. And you see a Junkers 88 landing. And then you see a picture standing me with my crew over maps and looking at that. And he said, yeah, that's you. Things like that. The Russians were without any scruple. They hit you. The interrogation took place. You were amongst big lights. You don't see anybody, but you can't see anybody because of the lights. And the interrogators, you can change them, several of them. And they always hammer it. Yeah, you said that and that, now you say the opposite. Very skillful. From the beginning on, I was clear about me. It was clear that I couldn't play cat and mouse with N and KWD, the Gestapo, the Russian Gestapo, or you want to call it, because they're too skillful. So the only way is just don't say things they want to hear. And that is, they made it point out, even critical things. How strong is the engine of Junkers 88, one of the engines? Something they know anyhow, but they wanted me to say it, and I didn't say it. Things like that. And then they hit you. And the hunger was taking its tribute. My weight was 80 kilograms, which is 80 pounds. And 3 months later, my weight was 88 pounds. And you were off your home, you didn't get anything to eat. Water you got. And when you came to the interrogation, there was a table always filled up with bad things, which smelled good to eat. So you can have all that, but at first answer a few questions. So finally, you were carried back. Out of mind, back into yourself, I was.
How long were you there in the prison?
In Lubyanka, it was about 3 months, 3.5 months. And then finally they carried me out of Moscow. And I came into the camp in Krasnogorsk, near Moscow, which was later on one of the most famous prisoner camps with the Soviet Union, because all the generals and later on all this came there. There I came to the camps. All over the 7 years I was altogether in, I don't know how many, 14, 20 different camps, because they used to travel us around after a certain while to avoid that we get too much acquainted with the area, with the guards and all that. So this is, they did it.
Were there many attempts at escape from the camps?
Some, yeah. And we had very bad exercise. It was a fine young man, and he escaped. And after 3 days or so, they got him. And he came back nearly dead, the way that destroyed him. And that was done purposely to show us that is what happens to you if you day after. But when you are behind the Volga somewhere in that area, where do you want to go?
But there are people who did. I know from one case, he was even in Makuto, far in the east. And he escaped and reached Austria. After the war. As far as his feet carried him. There's a book written about that. There was quite something. A few people escaped. Later on, after the war was over, it was not so dangerous anymore. When you're caught, when they caught somebody, okay, then he was for 25 years in. That is clear. But as I had described, I was lucky also to come through in 1949, because I was practically already on the way to Siberia for 25 years. I was lucky. There was my guardian angel to have the hands of me, and I made it.
You've mentioned many times that you were helped along the way. Do you think that help is what kept you alive, or did you have some reason, some stronger reason yourself that kept you going through them?
Of course, I was absolutely determined not to give in. And I wanted to come back alive. And not to give the funds to a Russian strength program. I didn't want that. So that kept me going. And many others too. Unless you have read the Block 6. So, this kept us going.
Tell me about Block 6, right? The friendships you developed there and some of the stories.
There were, of course, amongst the Russian propaganda run on high tours in the camps to turn around the prisoners. But of course, there were always some who looked through it and were not influenced by it. And we opened our mouths, those who did. And through the, of course, the Russian didn't like it. So finally, they started to pull these out and put them in a special jail, which then was called Block 6. Because, and there we found ourselves with about 200 men far away, with all ranks and all decorations and the best of the best, so to say. And soon the Russians realized that they made a big mistake, because we held it together. The Russian didn't know how to handle that. And so finally, this became Block 6. It was a finale amongst the prisoners, particularly those who were on the other side falling to the Russians. We are their biggest enemies. But their friendships developed, which lasted up to then. I'm now one of the last ones. Just a few days ago, one of my close friends died again, one of them. So more or less, I'm now alone. But of course, there was something which warmed your heart, showed that when you keep together. A friend of mine, as we married, came and said to my wife, "You will never in your whole life see your husband as naked as we have seen one another, the soul." And it's true. So little things, we were so cramped, the circumstances of life were so miserable, so cramped, that's true now, that we had to keep our discipline in some way, otherwise chaos would happen. So we decided that nobody would offer the familiar doom to somebody. We kept the sea, the formal sea, and the military grade. When I, as lieutenant, was addressing a captain, I would say, "Herr Hauptmann." I wouldn't say only his name, and then his name. So we kept the military discipline, which is old tradition in Germany. And only after my friend Dehling and I came over the border back to West Germany, then he said, "Now we can say do."
Tell me about, there was an incident in Block 6 to do with extra heat and some wood. Tell me about that incident.
That is a famous church going of Yellow World. And that's well documented even in one of the books. We had no wood to heat our stoves. And our engineers had found out that this construction of the roof was strong enough so that we can cut out here and there some of the beams without endangering the structure. And that would be done by night with self-made saws and so on. And the Russians were not that open, so our chimneys were smoking red and warm. So after one day after they had discovered it, how it worked, I want to not go into much detail here. They decided we have to take them out of the block, and we put them in this old church, which was not far away, still in the surrounding of the camp, and there they can die if they want. And they pushed us in there. Immediately we all went on hunger strike. And we, because there was no survival, it was winter, mid-winter, and the temperatures were hell below zero. And you can't heat a church with just a little drum or kind of self-made oven. Totally impossible. So either we die of starvation, or the Russian people finally they gave up.
Why do you think the hunger strike was so successful? What was it about a hunger strike that
made it? The Russians were always afraid of Moscow. You see, Moscow is big, Moscow is far away, and we are the masters here. But they were afraid if a commission from Moscow comes and looks after whether they have kept the rules, they are troubled. Because all these authorities, they are stole from us at first the food. We didn't get the food which was officially assigned to the prisoners. We get a fraction of it only. That is why we all were starving so much. Then we were misused for work, for all kind of work, which was not officially the rule of the Soviet Union. So all this. And there were briberies and all this kind. And the local authorities were deadly afraid if the commission comes from Moscow. So that was the lever we used always. When you start a hunger strike, there was a law in the Soviet Union. After 3 days hunger strike, Moscow immediately has to be informed. The Ministry of Interior himself. Because the communists waged war against the Tsaristic government before World War I with hunger strike. And that is how they became strong. So that is what they were afraid of. I myself have been on hunger strike 3 times. Each time successful.
What was the longest length of
a hunger strike? It was nearly a week. And we started out with nothing. See, my weight, as I said, was maybe then 90 pounds or something like that. So, and the Russian doctor, who was absolutely on our side, she was pleading with the authorities, stop that, they're all dying. And as the smell in our room was acetone, then that was a sign that the lungs are starting to dissolve. Then she made really noise and said, now stop. Or I blame you all for the deaths of these people. So I stopped them.
And they let you go back to Block 6?
That was not a hunger strike. That was at the lens or windows. The hunger strike there was much faster. We were 2 nights, that whole thing, that was the end of the story. There was the Russians, and they are reacting differently than other people would expect. I always like to tell the story of my interpreter, who was an older gentleman, over 60 years old. He was born in Russia. I told his story that one day a high general from Moscow came, and of course our Russian commandant, major, show him around the prison where the bad fascists are, Block 6. And as they walked, our interpreter, who didn't hear very well anymore, walked right behind them, tried to listen to them. And they became annoyed. Finally, they turned around and shouted at him how only Russian military can shout. And we saw our interpreter getting red, and he was a choleric. And as the rat reached his head up there, he exploded, and he shouted back, much worse than they had shouted, in a way that now they will kill him. But after finally he had to breathe, this general said to this other officer, listen to him, he speaks our language. They turned around and let him go in. Nobody would have ever expected such a reaction. So they reacted always differently. And it took me 7 years to understand that I would never understand that problem.
Tell me about the role that the Antifa played in the camp.
That was the saddest story of all. I was brought up under the impression that a German officer said, honor will never allow him to commit treason. But these people were so afraid and were so threatened and were so weak that they finally lost